Morning's lesson is taken from 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for everyone, for kings and all who are in high positions, so that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and dignity. This is right and is acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who desires everyone to be saved and to come to the knowledge of truth. For there is one God, there is also one mediator between God and humankind, Jesus Christ, himself human, who gave himself as ransom for all. This was attested at the right time. For this I was appointed a herald and an apostle. I'm telling the truth, I'm not lying, a teacher of the Gentiles in faith and truth. This is the word of the Lord.
I really like it when the Sunday after Thanksgiving is not the first Sunday in Advent. Some stores go right from promoting Halloween, which starts as soon as back to school is over, to pushing Christmas. And we complain about it, but what does this approach to the holidays tell us about the world we live in? Halloween, which, let's be honest, is popular because it's about getting candy, is promoted for weeks. And as soon as it ends, the culture starts pushing its version of Christmas, which is buy stuff and get stuff for yourself and other people. And lost in the rush, in a lot of stores, is another holiday in the middle. Thanksgiving is the middle child who is ignored by parents who are too focused on the kids on either side. I think Thanksgiving gets lost because it's not about getting candy or stuff you don't need, but about being thankful and grateful for life and for all our blessings. It's about a spiritual practice we call thanksgiving, maybe thankfulness, or gratitude, which is hugely important for contentment. Beautiful word, contentment. We complain about stress, but we miss this chance for contentment. When you're content, you're not stressed. Materialism is about creating a discontent unless we get more stuff. Thanksgiving runs absolutely contrary to that idea. And in some ways, Thanksgiving is the more religious holiday in our culture. After all, who are you thankful to? But while the toy stores and their ilk haven't found a way to get us to spend too much on their stuff at Thanksgiving, the grocery stores have done their best to get us to go whole turkey. In fact, when Cheryl, the office administrator, was searching for an image to be our visual theme today, like what you have, it's been on the slide, the grateful, thankful, blessed slide, the right next to it on the search, the image search, right next to the one on your bulletin, was one of the same font and look, but a very different message. It's the same look. And even that it's the same look, there's a lesson in there. That would preach, too. Mary Lou read for us, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for everyone, for kings and all who are in high positions. Paul urged Timothy to promote the practice of thanksgiving among the people Timothy pastored there in Ephesus, including being thankful for their government officials. Think of the corruption of those later Caesars. And Paul said, show thanksgiving even in regard to them. If they can do it, so can we. Thanksgiving, the attitude of gratitude, shapes your character toward being more Christ-like. Think about it. If you're never thankful, you're telling God he's doing a bad job. Unless you figured out a way to never have to stand before God and make an accounting for your life, you might want to change that message. Just saying. Now, our Old Testament lesson describes God's desire to restore his people to a position of thankfulness after, in their disobedience, they move themselves out from under his sheltering protection. This is Joel chapter 2, verses 21 to 27. Do not fear, O soil, O land. Be glad and rejoice, for the Lord has done great things. Do not fear, you animals of the field, for the pastures of the wilderness are green. The tree bears its fruit. The fig tree and vine give their full yield. O children of Zion, be glad and rejoice in the Lord your God. For he has given the early rain for your vindication. He has poured down for you abundant rain, the early and the later rain, as before. The threshing floors shall be full of grain. The vats shall overflow with wine and oil. I will repay you for the years that the swarming locust has eaten, the hopper, the destroyer, and the cutter, my great army which I sent against you. You shall eat in plenty and be satisfied, and praise the name of the Lord your God, who has dealt wondrously with you. And my people shall never again be put to shame. You shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I, the Lord, am your God, and there is no other. And my people shall never again be put to shame. Did you hear him say that twice? Never again be put to shame. So here's the situation of Joel. Joel prophesied in the land of Judah, the southern kingdom, in the exciting and pivotal days of King Uzziah. Remember the vision of Isaiah in the year Uzziah died? Well, up to this point, Uzziah's reign had been a time of great economic prosperity. He had taken control of the caravan routes that led from Arabia. He led the armies of Judah to significant military victories over the Philistines. He fortified Jerusalem. And archaeological digs have shown the effectiveness of how Uzziah's reign helped farmers do better as well. Agricultural reform. And then, a locust plague had descended on Judah, ruining all the crops. And not only was the basic economy of the country disrupted, but all levels of society were deeply affected. Perhaps worst of all, with the crops gone, they couldn't continue to offer sacrifices. That was the central activity of how they expressed their relationship with God. I thought about that as a comparison to 9/11 here. When 9/11 happened, there was a sudden surge of church attendance. Lasted about 2 weeks. There was some earnest coming to God, particularly among the troops who were activated against the Taliban. But stateside, it was similar to the situation we see in the prophet Joel. No depth. People had no basic knowledge of God. They just sort of absorbed the image, the kind of fuzzy God image that people might talk about in general. A God who resembles the harmless grandfather who just wants to see the young people have a good time. Here in Joel's time, people suddenly cried out in panic. These bugs have ruined our lives. Help, God, where are you? And in these catastrophic circumstances, Joel saw the judgment of God on Judah. Now, God had abundantly blessed the Judah of Uzziah's day. But the people had taken God and his blessings for granted. They hadn't been thankful. Faith had degenerated into an empty going through the motions. Their lives degenerated into moral decay. But God lit a fire under Joel, and it revealed to him that the locust plague was his warning And really, a warning is a mercy. His warning that greater judgment would hit the people of Judah at any time, unless they repented, unless they returned to full fellowship with God. And he says, if they did, God would abundantly pardon them. He'd restore the health of the land and give them again the elements needed so that they could offer sacrifices and restore that relationship with God. That ceremonial system was just to provide a way for them to express their heart's love for God. But by ignoring God, taking him for granted, they forfeited their right to it. They needed to turn around, a repentant heart, to allow ceremony and spiritual condition to line up again. God wanted them to know that if they softened their hearts and returned to him, there would be blessing. So this passage describes a time of restoration after the plague. And there would be no fear, no want, and no shame. That's a pretty good time. So what Joel's saying here is, when we find our joy in God, true abundance, and not judgment, is God's last word to his people. Every Christian believer has situations in our lives where we've had to make dramatic changes in order to get right with God. We woke up and said, oh boy, something needs to change. Even if we've received discipline, this is one example of God's promise to restore us fully, to wipe the slate clean. And that's a beautiful thing. Have you had your own onslaught of locusts in your life? Have you had those times? Would you like God to restore the years the locusts have eaten? It's a powerful image. There is an enemy to our souls who wants us to think that once we've messed up, relationship's over. We can never find our way back to God. That is not even true in the rest of our lives. And we have a modern image that lets us know we can get back on track. This is Moses, year 40 in the desert. All these backseat drivers. Recalculating. Knock it off. We can follow our spiritual GPS and get back on track. Thankfulness is key to finding our way back to God. But there are obstacles. Snakes in the grass, if you will. And hatred is an obstacle to thankfulness. Walter Anderson was longtime editor of Parade magazine, back when it was more than 4 pages long. He recorded a conversation with his friend, Nobel Prize Peace winner, author, and Holocaust survivor, Elie Wiesel. Anderson asked him, why don't you hate those responsible? And Wiesel replied, it would be silly to reduce such enormous horror, a tragedy unprecedented in the history of man, to hatred. That would be a betrayal of my parents and my friends, because if I hated, I would betray their deaths. The enemy wanted us to hate them. I refuse. I will not grant the killer's wish. In the Bible, the first death is a murder. Cain is slaying his brother Abel. Is the point of the murder that brothers ultimately must kill each other? Or does the story mean that whoever kills, kills his brother? We're told not to hate our brother in our hearts. Hatred inevitably destroys the hater as well as the hatred. The choice is ours. I choose to believe that he who kills, kills his brother and finally himself. We are responsible for what we are. We are responsible for what we are. For what we are. Jesus says we are to repay as our Heavenly Father repays. Evil with good. Repay curse with blessing. repay enmity by acts of kindness. The inexhaustible and gracious love of God that has changed our lives is what we are to imitate and to share with others. We are to follow the strategy of God that aims at moving people to awareness, conversion, and friendship through undeserved kindness, grace, love, and generosity. Before this Thanksgiving weekend is over, perhaps we can resolve to have our next holiday gathering focus on kindness, on grace, and on love. Hatred is an obstacle to Thanksgiving, but when we find our joy in God, true abundance and not judgment is God's last word to his people. Materialism is also an obstacle to Thanksgiving. A Christian virtue involving money that may seem quaint to people today is frugality. Dallas Willard wrote, "In frugality, we abstain from using money or goods at our disposal in ways that merely gratify our desires or our hunger for status, glamour, or luxury." The spiritually wise person has always known that frivolous consumption corrupts the soul away from trust in God, worship of God, and service to God. And what's more, focusing on the stuff we can get injures our neighbors as well. In our current world, a large part of the freedom that comes from frugality is freedom from the spiritual bondage caused by financial debt. If you're caught in debt, you know that kind of controls your life. And more Americans are getting deeper in debt. If you're having trouble with debt, I've been wondering if it's time to run Financial Peace University here again. The issues of being frugal, of being content, and consumption, they're all connected. Being a good manager of our resources includes seeking to get out of debt as quickly as possible. Freedom from debt brings freedom in life. Being fixated on stuff brings its own problems. And I want to illustrate this with a story from a guy I think tells the best stories in the world, and that's Doug Scalise. He told this story. A young, successful businessman bought one of the most expensive cars around, a Ferrari GTO. He took it out for a spin, stopped at a red light, and an old man on a moped pulled up next to him. Oh, Sarah. And the old man, and I got to tell you, in my mind, this guy sounds to me like Frank. Not that he's old, but I just hear the Midwestern, the lovely Ohio sound. And so this fella on a moped pulls up next to him, looks over at the sleek, shiny car, and says, "What kind of car you got there, sonny?" "A Ferrari GTO. Costs $500,000. "That's a lot of money," says the old man. "Why does it cost so much?" "Because this car can do 150 miles an hour." The young man said that rather proudly. And the moped driver asks, "Mind if I look inside?" "No problem," replied the owner. So the old man pokes his head into the window, looks around. And sitting back on the moped, the old man said, "That's a pretty nice car, all right?" And just then the light changed, and the driver decided to show the old man just what his car could do. He floored it, and in less than 5 seconds, the speedometer read 120 miles an hour. But suddenly, the driver notices a dot in his rear view mirror, and it was getting closer. He took his foot off the gas. As he looked to see what it was, and whoosh, something whipped right by him. "What on earth could be going faster than my Ferrari?" the young man said to himself. And then ahead of him, he saw a dot coming toward him. Whoosh, and went by again, heading in the opposite direction. And is it true? It looked like the old man on the moped.
Couldn't be, he thought. How could a moped outrun a Ferrari? Once more, he saw the dot in his rearview mirror, followed by a bang as a speeding object crashed into the back of the car. The young man jumped out and saw the older man lying on the pavement. He ran to him and said, "Is there anything I can do for you?" The old man whispered, "Yes." "Well, what is it? Tell me." "Unhook my suspenders from your rearview mirror." There will always be people with more money than sense. We all are the guys on the moped. Don't worry about the Ferrari guy. None of us are in danger of being the Ferrari guy. But we're all in danger. Peering in, envying, is clearly hazardous to your health. And even $500,000 cars have unintended consequences. And even Ferraris eventually land in the junkyard, where rust destroys. Materialism is an obstacle to thankfulness. But when we find our joy in God, true abundance, not judgment, is God's last word to his people. One of the things people look forward to, Thanksgiving and these days, is watching football. Football, you've got to play both directions, or somebody has to. You've got to have a team that does. In regards to hatred and material greed, we need to play defense and be on our guard lest those attitudes creep into our lives. We don't want them to gain ground against us. The hard part about defending against hatred and material greed, it's not as clear an opponent on the other side of the field. Football, they're all wearing a uniform. You can tell that's one of them. Hatred and greed, they kind of creep around. They masquerade. Spiritually, we have to play defense against things that rise up even within us. How do we play offense? How do we pursue thankfulness? Well, first of all, recognize that as long as we live, we're in a spiritual fight. Remember the movie Rocky, the first one? 1976. Sylvester Stallone played an amateur boxer who gets an unexpected chance to fight the champion, Apollo Creed, for the title. And Creed doesn't take Rocky seriously. And early in the fight, Rocky stuns him, knocks him to the canvas. Apollo Creed's trainer. Okay, trivia time. Anybody? Duke Evers says to Creed, "He doesn't know it's a show. He thinks it's a fight." And Paul, in the reading Mary Lou gave for us, he's like Timothy's corner man. Timothy's in the fight, and Paul's coaching him. Paul's telling Timothy a similar thing. Following Jesus isn't a show. It's a fight. It's a battle every day of our lives. And if we don't realize that, we may get flattened and knocked to the canvas. We live in apathy while 3 billion go hungry. We gather to thank God while our neighbors have no idea where their lives come from or where they're going. Later in this letter, Paul says, fight the good fight. The point is that maintaining and living the faith require the energy and discipline of a good athlete. Rendering good for evil, blessing for cursing, overcoming evil with good, this is the good fight of the faith. But what if, reminiscent of Rocky at the beginning of the movie, you've allowed your spiritual muscles to grow flabby? Do you have a clip here? Or no, you don't have the clip. Okay. we all remember who Rocky's trainer was, Burgess Meredith. Character's name was Mickey. And he says to Rocky, "You have the talent to become a good fighter. And instead of that, you became a leg breaker." And Rocky says, "It's a living." And Mickey replies, "It's a waste of life." Have you been doing some recalculating? It wasn't too late for Rocky. And it isn't too late for any of us. Unhook your suspenders from hatred and greed. The road back begins with thankfulness. And God will restore the years the locusts have eaten. When we find our joy in God, true abundance and not judgment is God's last word to his people. And now unto the blessed and only sovereign, the King of kings and the Lord of lords, who alone has immortality and dwells in inapproachable light, whom no one has ever seen or can see, to him be honor and eternal dominion.